As my grandmother welcomes students to her one-room schoolhouse, I welcome you with her same bell to UUFM. Whether you're connoisseurs of classical, jazz, rock or rap, or a lover of the sweet silence, you are welcome here. I want to call your attention to our program today and our announcements. And I want to add a couple of announcements on there that we would really like to thank Pete Garfinkel and Karen Garrett for that beautiful music. And I'd like to give them another hand because that was just gorgeous. And then the other short announcement that I have is if Larry and Molly's class, RE class, would please stay in here this morning, we would really appreciate it. Whenever humans come together for any reason, music is there. Weddings, funerals, graduation from college, men marching off to war, stadium sporting events, a night on the town, prayer, a romantic dinner, mothers rocking their infants to sleep. Music is a part of the fabric of everyday life. This is our time in the program where we would like to recognize any joys or concerns that anyone in our congregation would like to share. I believe we're going to have the mic coming around, and we have a joy or concern already right here, so you get to go next, okay?
I'm Kathleen Oldfather with the Caring Committee, and I just want to announce that there will be a memorial here on Friday. I don't know the time yet, but I will put it out on the listserv, or if you really want to know, let me know. It will be for Jean Davis. Jean Davis died several weeks ago. She was living at Meadowlark and attended on and off here years ago and attended the Meadowlark service every month with her husband, Don. So anyway, I'll put it on the listserv, but if you really want to know for sure when that is, let me know today.
I have a joy that I turned 7 yesterday, and for a present, I got a watch.
Woo. I said a while ago, I got engaged and all that, and everybody wanted to meet Bree. Well, here she is. So here you go.
Jim Chanteau. I have a joy and a concern. The concern is Ann Martian's not here today, and the reason is that she's in Kansas City with one of her daughters who's expecting a child any moment now. Last I heard, it had not been delivered yet, but probably within a day.
Were there any more joys or concerns that anyone would like to share this morning? Okay, well, I'd like to thank you that shared, and if we can keep in mind those joys and concerns that were not voiced. I would like to call the children up, if they would, if we can come over here for the children's conversation. That sounds really awesome.
That's all the kind of spring, that's all the kind of colors, sprinkles are in. Right?
That probably is all the kind of color sprinkles there are. Well, Today in our service, we're going to talk about songs. And we're going to talk about songs in history and their impact on history. Because a lot of times people write songs about big issues and not just about fun things or about love, but about things that are going on in the world. And the song that we're going to talk about with you guys is called Blowin' in the Wind, and it was by a guy named Bob Dylan. And yeah, she saw the paper. And the cool thing about this is when we get to the book part, everybody in the congregation is going to sing the song while you guys get to see the pictures. Now, the reason that Bob Dylan wrote this song is that I think it was written back in 1963, and a lot of people didn't have rights back then. And in some parts of the country, there were some people, they couldn't vote, they couldn't go to restaurants, they couldn't live where they wanted to live. And these were African American people. And so Bob Dylan wrote this song. But the really neat thing about this song is the way that it's written, it can address all issues that are coming up today. It asks why, when this world is going wrong, why aren't we doing anything? And how do we find the answers to it? So while I show you guys the pictures, and if you guys can see the words, you can sing along too, but we're going to sing the story. So I believe everybody in their order of service has the lyrics to Blowin' in the Wind.
Choose a note you like, Larry.
And I'll even start you out if you want. I'll be brave. Okay? Are you guys ready? How many roads must a man go down before you call him a man? Yes, and how many seas must white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Does it need to be higher? How many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head pretending he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? Yes, and how many years must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Good job. Go now in peace.
In a moment, we'll hear Josh White's rendition of the haunting lament, protest song, but also a lament, Strange Fruit. Josh White, who was black, was born 99 years ago in 1914 in the black section of Greenville, South Carolina. His father was a tailor and a preacher. Josh's parents were very proper and formal and always addressed each other as Mr. and Mrs. White, Mr. or Mrs. White. When Josh White was a seven-year-old boy, a bill collector, a white man, entered their home, and during the ensuing confrontation, rudely spat on the kitchen floor. Josh's father, indignant at this insult to his wife, who kept an immaculate house, grabbed the bill collector by the collar and pushed him out the door. A short time later, five sheriff's deputies, all white men, showed up at the door, beat Josh's father rather severely, right in front of the boy's eyes, tied him behind a horse, and dragged him through town to the jail. He was permanently incapacitated by the abuse and spent the rest of his life in a mental institution where he died prematurely 9 years later from the effects of the abuse. 1 year after this incident, 8-year-old Josh White became what is called a lead boy for a series of blind street musicians, a sort of seeing eye boy for them. He spent the next 5 years touring the Deep South as lead boy. This was during the Jim Crow reign of terror, of course, in the 1920s, and Josh suffered ongoing abuse and deprivation, including malnutrition, that led to ill health in later years and an early death at age 55. During his years as lead boy, he personally witnessed tar and featherings, lynchings, immolations of blacks, and was himself beaten and jailed without cause. In spite of all that, or maybe partly because of all that, he eventually became a very successful folk musician, became a favorite of Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt, was a guest at the Roosevelt White House on several occasions. But you can well imagine that the experience of his youth made a permanent mark on his musical interpretation, as you will perhaps hear in today's offertory.
One of the most powerful protest songs of the 20th century, Strange Fruit, is part of a long tradition of American protest music as old as the nation itself. In harmony with the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of speech, music has been an expression of faith, freedom, peace, and justice. Throughout American history, songs have cried out against inequality, poverty, and war, and in support of workers, civil, and human rights. The catalog of protest music is vast. This program highlights just a few of the countless American singing traditions, songs, and songwriters whose words and music served as catalysts for thought, action, and even social change. After the founding of the United States in 1776, some of the new nation's first protest songs were by and about slaves. These songs were rooted in religious hymns and spirituals with biblical themes. Titles included Steal Away, Go Down Moses, Let My People Go, We Shall Be Free, and Run to Jesus, the song Frederick Douglass said inspired him to escape slavery in 1838.
There's an amazing book entitled Slave Songs of the United States that was published in 1867 by three music preservationists who had traveled all over the Midwest, East Coast, and Southern states during and immediately after the Civil War. And they collected and documented slave songs and also black regional dialects. And they collected and preserved almost 150 songs. The vast majority were directly from the mouths of the former slaves themselves. But they were of the opinion, after going through this exercise, that many thousands more songs either had already been lost or were about to be lost. The compilers said, following their effort, said the following, quote, "The best we can do with paper and type, or even with voices, will convey but a faint shadow of the originals. The black voices we experienced had a peculiar quality that nothing can imitate, and the intonations and delicate variations of even one singer cannot be reproduced on paper. We despair of conveying any notion of the effect of a number of singing together, especially in a complicated shout, like, I can't stay behind my Lord, or turn sinner, turn O. There is no singing in parts as we understand it. The lead singer starts the words of each verse, often improvising, and the others who base him, as it is called, that's B-A-S-E, not B-A-S-S, strike in with a refrain or even join in with a solo. When the bass voices begin, the leader often stops, leaving the rest of his words to be guessed at, or they may be taken up by the other singers. The bassers seem to follow their own whims, beginning and leaving off when they please and striking harmonies that produce the effect of a marvelous complication and variety, and yet with the most perfect timing, rarely discordant. What makes it even harder to unravel a thread of melody out of this strange network is that they often strike sounds that cannot be precisely represented in print. They abound in slides from one note to another and in turns and cadences rather than articulated notes. It's difficult to express the entire character of these slave ballads by mere musical notes and signs. The odd turns made in the throat, the curious rhythmic effect produced by single voices chiming in at different irregular intervals, seems almost as impossible to place on the score as the singing of birds, unquote. Stacy mentioned the song Run to Jesus and that in connection with Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass mentioned on several occasions that this song, when he was a boy, is what first gave him the idea that he might actually escape from slavery. I've got the words and the music printed on that pink sheet, and I'm told that it's too complicated for you to sing. but I am going to go through it, and maybe you'll chime in as you feel able. The song that gave Frederick Douglass the idea that he could be a free man. Run to Jesus, shun the danger. I don't expect to stay much longer here. Run to Jesus, shun the danger. I don't expect to stay much longer here. He will be our dearest friend and will help us to the end. I don't expect to stay much longer here. Run to Jesus, shun the danger. I don't expect to stay much longer here. Oh, I thought I heard them say there were lions in the way. I don't expect to stay much longer here. Run to Jesus, shun the danger. I don't expect to stay much longer here. Many mansions there will be, one for you and one for me. I don't expect to stay much longer here. Run to Jesus, shun the danger. I don't expect to stay much longer here. It's amazing to think that that simple song gave this great abolitionist the idea that he could be a free person. It just shows you the power of even a simple protest song. Choir.
Sinner man,
oh, to save us, sinner man.
Don't
Many decades before the Civil War, religious traditions had merged with work and field songs, evolving into protest songs, sometimes overtly political calls to action and rebellion. As early as 1813, a secret slave organization in South Carolina opened and closed their meetings with a song that included these lines: "Arise, arise, shake off your chains. Your cause is just, so heaven ordains. To you shall freedom be proclaimed. Call every Negro from his task. Wrest the scourge from Buckra's hand and drive each tyrant from the land." This song was later sung by the black carpenter Denmark Vesey and his followers, who launched a failed 1822 slave revolt in Charleston, South Carolina. Vesey had been a slave and had purchased his own freedom prior to planning the revolt. "Follow the Drinking Gourd" was a song of the Underground Railroad, a network that helped slaves escape to freedom in the North. In the song, the Drinking Gourd was code for the Big Dipper constellation, the beacon to freedom always visible in the northern sky. Additional code words describe signposts on the escape route out of Alabama and Mississippi. Debuting in 1839, the Hutchinson Family Singers of New Hampshire were one of the best-known musical groups of the mid-1800s. Famous for their harmonies, the group made their mark with a mix of sentimental ballads and protest songs in the European-American traditions. The subjects of their protest songs ranged from temperance to women's rights to abolitionism, winning fans and friends that included Frederick Douglass, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, and Abraham Lincoln. Although the name and composition of the group changed, the Hutchinson family played in one form or another for nearly 40 years. The Hutchinson family singers often set new words to popular music. This tradition of transforming revered patriotic tunes into protest songs was favored by early union organizers and continues to this day. After hearing a song about abolitionist John Brown, who had been hanged in 1859 for leading an attempted slave insurrection, Julia Ward Howe penned new verses more appropriated to the Civil War effort. Her Battle Hymn of the Republic, set to music of John Brown's body, quickly became the anthem of the Union forces. Howe's suffrage song used the tune of the popular song "America" to champion the women's suffrage movement. In the 1890s, workers began distributing strike song books to American cities. The Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, also known as the Wobblies, most completely combined songs and action in their movement for union building and workers' rights in the early 1900s. Songs are a central part of the organization's strategy of recruitment, solidarity, and strikes. These tunes showed a fluid adaptability to new lyrics to fit the moment, a trait important to many of the most famous protest songs throughout history. One of the best-known songs of this period was "Bread and Roses," originally a poem by James Oppenheim and put to music by Carolyn Kolsatt. The song was originally associated with a women's textile workers' strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1912, but was taken up by protest movements throughout the 20th century. The tune that most of us associate with this song was composed much later by Mimi Baez, sister of Joan Baez.
Hymnals to 109. We're gonna sing it to a tune that some of us prefer to the one in the hymnal. As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle to four men.
For they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our life shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. As we go marching, marching, unnumbered women dead go crying through their singing, their ancient call for bread. Small art and love and beauty, their drudging spirits new. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. As we go marching, marching, we bring the greater days. The rising of the women is the rising of the race. No more the drudge and idler tend that toil where one reposes. Ring of life's glories, bread and roses, bread and roses. Our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies, bread and roses, bread and roses.
Didn't know about that. Didn't know that was coming.
Joe Hill was the best known of the Wobblies songwriters, setting new lyrics of protest to well-known tunes everyone could sing along with. Hill's revolutionary song, The Preacher and the Slave, is a parody of In the Sweet By and By, a religious song about the rewards of heaven after the toil of life on earth. Hill mocks the Salvation Army's preachers who offer solace to those who wait rather than fighting for relief. The decade of the 1930s that gave birth to Abel Meeropol's powerful anti-lynching song, Strange Fruit, was an explosive time for the American protest song, and the Depression inspired artists to decry the harsh realities around them. In Harlem and elsewhere, the African-American tradition had changed music forever, and jazz now reigns supreme in its third decade. With the influence of jazz on popular music, the distinct African-American and European-American protest song traditions began to come together for the first time in songs like Strange Fruit. And beyond New York, young Woody Guthrie, who was born a little over 100 years ago in July, was working his way across an American countryside deeply scarred by the Depression, singing at workers' meetings and writing the songs that would make up the 1940 Dust Bowl Ballads, a breakthrough album of protest songs. In Kentucky, Aunt Molly Jackson was singing songs with striking coal miners, writing an important chapter in the history of protest music. Amidst this prolific production of protest songs attacking racism, classism, and the economic inequality, one song soared to number one on the music charts, Rudy Valley and Bing Crosby's Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? By E.Y. Harburg and Jay Gorney. The Almanac Singers, which included Woody Guthrie, Josh White, a young Pete Seeger, and many others, toured America before World War II, singing to support struggling workers everywhere. In the years after the war, Seeger would go on to become one of the great champions of folk and protest music. His group, The Weavers, recorded several big hits in the early 50s and helped to bring folk music into the mainstream. With the founding of the new Folkways record label in 1947, Seeger and musicians everywhere were exposed to groundbreaking recordings of little-known rural musicians and blues players like Huddy Leadbetter, known as Lead Belly. In Lead Belly's recordings, many in the general public and mainstream music community discovered the blues tradition for the first time, a tradition deeply rooted in African-American history, slavery, and protest.
This is a good one. I remember singing it to my children on long car rides.
They thought it would be funny to have the only banker in the room sing this. I just want to make sure that you understand that bankers, like Unitarians, come in many different shapes.
Amen.
And some of them are the sweetest, nicest, most generous people you would ever want to know.
I've traveled around this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer plowing sod and loam. I heard the auction hammer knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the farmer labored for. I saw the seamen standing idly by the shore. I heard the bosses saying, "We've got no work for you no more." But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the seamen sweated for. I saw the weary miner scrubbing coal dust from his back. I heard his children crying, "We've got no coal to heat our shack." But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the miner labored for. I've seen my brothers working throughout this mighty land. I prayed we'd get together and together make a stand. Then we'd own those banks of marble with a guard at every door. And we all would share the silver that we all have labored for.
Got another verse?
While urban folk music was shaking the cities, one of the greatest protest songs of all times was born during a strike in Charleston, South Carolina. In 1945, the striking workers of the Negro Food and Tobacco Union borrowed a gospel song written by Charles Tindley in 1900 entitled "I'll Overcome Someday" and made it one of their protest songs. The song quickly spread to union meetings across the country. The title and lyrics would change slightly, and the song, now known as "We Shall Overcome," became the unofficial anthem of the civil rights movement and beyond.
As Stacy said, Charles Tindley composed the gospel song "I'll Overcome Someday" in 1900. He, in turn, borrowed the tune from that song from an old slave song, an old anti-slavery song called "Many Thousand Gone," or "No More Auction Block for Me." And that song probably was sung by slaves on the plantation, but it was certainly sung by black soldiers during the Civil War as they marched. It was sort of a marching song. And Pete and Karen and Larry, and hopefully everybody else, is going to help us take a look at "We Shall Overcome" through history. We're going to sing the original version, "Many Thousand Gone." Then we're going to sing "I'll Overcome Someday," the 1900 version, and then we'll do a verse of "We Shall Overcome."
No more auction block for me,
no more, no,
no more. No more auction block for me,
many thousands gone.
No more peck of corn for me,
no more, no more.
me. No more, no, no more, no more driver's lash for me.
Many thousands on.
No more pint of salt for me.
No more, no more,
no more pint of salt for me.
Many thousands gone.
No more 100 lash for me.
No more, no more,
no more 100 lash for me.
Many thousands gone.
No more mistress fall for me.
No more, no
more, no more mistress fall for me.
Many thousands gone.
Can you hear the echo of "We Shall Overcome" in there? Now let's do "I'll Overcome Someday." One,
two. I'll overcome someday, I'll overcome someday. If in my heart I do not yield, I'll overcome someday. This world is one great battlefield with forces all arrayed. If in my heart I do not yield, I'll overcome someday. I'll overcome someday, I'll overcome someday. If in my heart I do not yield, I'll overcome someday. Both seen and unseen powers join to drive my soul astray. But with his word, a sword of mine, I'll overcome someday. I'll overcome someday, I'll overcome someday. But with his word, a sword of mine, I'll overcome someday. A thousand snares are set for me, and mountains in my way. If Jesus will my leader be, I'll overcome someday. I'll overcome someday, I'll overcome someday. If Jesus will my leader be, I'll overcome someday. My mind is not to do the wrong, but walk the narrow way. I'm praying as I journey on to overcome someday. To overcome someday, to overcome someday. I'm praying as I journey on to overcome someday.
And of course that finally became,
we shall overcome, we shall overcome, we shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe that we shall overcome someday.
The great era of protest in America saw a collision of music genres ranging from folk revival to gospel to rock and roll as musicians sang for change. Some 60s songwriters abandoned old tunes and general themes in favor of all-out cultural assaults or specific events. Bob Dylan's A Pawn in Their Game was written about the murder of a civil rights worker, Medgar Evers. Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young mourned the four students killed by the National Guard during a war protest at Kent State University. At the same time, other musicians from civil rights movement continued to reach into the past for protest songs from both the slave song tradition, such as Michael Row the Boat Ashore, and the Union song tradition, Florence Reese's 1932 song, Which Side Are You On?, was adapted by civil rights leader James Farmer. New songs against racism leapt into being too, including Nina Simone's Mississippi Goddamn, as well as If You Miss Me at the Back of the Bus. The hundreds of songs about Vietnam War included Jimi Hendrix's cover of Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, and Malvina Reynolds' What Have They Done to the Rain, as well as Country Joe McDonald's I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die Rag. Creedence Clearwater Revival's Fortunate Son, Edwin Starr's War, various works of Joan Baez and Buffy St. Marie's Universal Soldier.
I had some other comments that I forgot to make on We Shall Overcome, but I want to read you. The Highlander Folk School, which is now known as the Highlander Research and Education Center, has been in operation in Tennessee for more than 80 years. It's a social justice leadership training school where human rights activists go to study or teach. And in the mid-20th century, it focused on labor issues such as coal mine safety, union rights, also civil rights issues, whereas more recently it has come to focus, it shifted its focus to environmentalism, economic justice, voter disenfranchisement, democratic participation, poverty, LGBT rights. In the mid-1900s, Highlander participants included the likes of civil rights activists John Lewis, Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr., and folk singer Pete Seeger. In the late 1940s, a group of women strikers from the Negro Food and Tobacco Union of Charleston, South Carolina, visited the school and taught their version of I'll Overcome Someday, the song we just sang. They had adopted it from the original gospel tune from 1900, and they'd made it their protest song for their union demands. So they brought it to the folk school, and they taught it there. Pete Seeger happened to be at the school at the time and picked up the song. And at the school, the words were changed from I will overcome to we shall overcome, or we will overcome, which later became we shall overcome. Seeger then took the song and spread it widely. The change of I to we transformed the song from a statement of personal defiance into a shared anthem of a group or movement. And the influence of the Highlander Folk School helped elevate the song to its status as the anthem of the civil rights struggle. Remember the adage, popular music is a threat to entrenched interests. In the late 1950s, Southern newspapers began to attack the Highlander Folk School for supposedly fanning the flames of racial strife, but the folk school survives to this day. Remember John Lennon's anti-war song, Give Peace a Chance? That song became the anthem of the anti-war movement in the early 70s. John Lennon wanted to use his enormous popularity for fundraisers, voter registration drives, anti-war rallies and concerts. And these activities were planned to take place in many of the presidential primary states in 1972 when Nixon was seeking his re-election. Nixon tried to have Lennon expelled from the U.S., believing that his anti-war activities represented a threat to his re-election prospects. And he initiated a move to deport Lennon from the country based on either Lennon's drug use or any other pretext that he could drum up from a relentless and sustained investigation. J. Edgar Hoover's FBI put Lennon under surveillance in 1971, and Lennon had to spend years fighting deportation efforts in the courts. In 1973, the U.S. administration ordered Lennon to leave the country. He was able to delay his banishment until Nixon resigned in 1974 following the Watergate scandal. The expulsion order on Lennon was then rescinded after Nixon's successor, Gerald Ford, showed no interest whatever in continuing the harassment. Lennon secured his green card, and when Jimmy Carter assumed office in 1977, Lennon was a special invitee to the inaugural dinner. So the protest song, Give Peace a Chance, might not have all by itself put the fear of political downfall into Richard Nixon, but it was certainly emblematic of the growing tide of opposition to the Vietnam War and Nixon's machinations to manufacture a pretext for expelling the songbird reminds us of the argument in Plato's Dialogue that musical innovation is a danger to the state.
After the civil rights and anti-Vietnam movements of the 1960s, the American protest song tradition splintered into a plethora of angry anthemic styles, ranging from the black power hip-hop of Public Enemy's Fight the Power to the neo-punk of Green Day's American Idiot to updates of 60s protest rock like Neil Young's ode to George W. Bush, Let's Impeach the President. While rock continues to voice social concerns in the 80s, two new forms grabbed the mic of protest. The punk movement combined with anger, alienation, and politics in songs like KYEO, by Fugazi about the Persian Gulf War in 1991 and the sweeping 1985 Stars and Stripes of Corruption by the Dead Kennedys. Later, riot girl bands like Bikini Kill and Babes in Toyland continued the punk protest tradition, turning their lyrical sights on sexism. Rap also emerges as a protest genre, beginning with the Grandmaster Flash's The Message, which offered up a long lament of the harsh realities for poor African Americans. Celebrated rappers dispensed powerful social critique in songs like Boogie Down Productions' Stop the Violence and NWA's F the Police. With rappers Ice Cube and Paris Direction, more pointed protest songs like I Wanna Kill Same and Bush Killa about the 1991 Gulf War. Women rappers like Lauryn Hill and Mary J. Blige offered in their own American critiques of sexism, racism, and materialism in songs like Queen Latifah's hit Unity, attacking the disrespecting of black women. Musicians in every genre continue to write protest songs, although only few receive widespread airplay or distribution. Tracy Chapman's politically aware song, Talkin' About a Revolution, was released in 1988. Although the song didn't catch fire in this country, it became wildly popular in Tunisia during the Tunisian Revolution in 2011, a revolution which launched the Arab Spring. Diverse rockers like Bruce Springsteen, Annie DeFranco, Steve Earle, and System of a Down have contributed to the protest lexicon in the last few years, some tackling specific injustices, others taking on the larger implications of America's tragedy and response since September 11, 2001. Hip-hop and rap artists like Michael Franti and Spearhead, Outkast, and KRS-One, who traditionally tackle social themes, continue to record critical songs, while electronic artists like DJ Shadow have begun to contribute protest works as well. Other progressive artists, including Bonnie Raitt, George Clinton, Rage Against the Machine, and others, take on issues that range from environmentalism to economic injustice to anti-war to media takeovers. Will these songs have an impact? Only time will tell how long their songs will last or what their meanings they will take on in the future.
I already knew before planning this program, helping Stacy plan this program, that protest songs had great power to change society. The thing I did not realize until today was that the singing of protest songs has the power to slow the clock. Who knew? So we are now going to have Larry doing a final song, and I'm hoping Larry will have four or five final songs.
Well, one of the effective things in talking with children is to tell them of your own experiences at their age. And so my lesson plan for the RE class today was to talk to them about protest songs and about my experience of it. And since the children are not here, let me tell you a little bit about it, because I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama in the 1940s and 50s, and the only black people I came in contact with were the gardener at my neighbor's house and the wonderful woman who took care of me and my brother while my parents were at work. This was the early days of the two-parent, two-job family. And so interestingly enough, or maybe not surprisingly, when I would talk with the black lady, Willie Mae McKinney, who made the greatest peanut butter and jelly sandwiches you've ever run into, my favorite team baseball team was the New York Yankees, and hers was were the Cleveland Indians. And at that time, 1954, I thought, well, she likes the Cleveland Indians because she has relatives in Cleveland. And maybe that's right. But the Cleveland Indians were the team that hired Larry Doby, the first black baseball player in the American League. Okay, we all know about Jackie Robinson. That was National League. Larry Doby was in the American League. So anyway, in the 1950s, when, you know what was going on. I didn't know what was going on. The Birmingham News did not feature the marches on Selma. This was a communist plot. And not until I went away to college in 1960 did I start really learning about these things. In any case, what I was going to tell the kids was, when I was your age, think about riding on the school bus, riding somewhere on the school bus. All your black classmates would sit in the back, and you would sit in the front. Because when I was a kid, and I rode the buses, the public buses, public transportation in Alabama, in Birmingham, black people sat at the back. And in the song we're going to sing, we're going to see how that changed. In those days, the black people could not eat at lunch counters. They had to go around to the back and knock on the door, place your order, get your food, and eat it somewhere else. And so people organized picket lines for those to picket those places so that it was uncomfortable for whites to walk in. What happened to the picketers? They were put in jail. What they were doing was illegal. They're breaking the law. And policemen, you know, the good guys, put them in jail. There were public swimming pools, but they were white only. The black kids swam in the creek, or as the song says, in the Mississippi River. But these songs, as Stacy and Dick have pointed out, do help bring change, because this song points out that in each verse will contrast what happened, the way it was, and what happened. Okay, and in my own view, the greatest thing that happened is the verse that goes, "If you miss me in the cotton field, you can't find me nowhere. Come on down to the courthouse. I'll be voting right there." Okay. So here's the song, "If You Miss Me at the Back of the Bus." And you'll catch on and sing it. Come in as you feel comfortable, okay? So here's the way it goes. "If you miss me at the back of the bus, you can't find me nowhere. Come on over to the front of the bus. I'll be riding up there. I'll be riding up there. I'll be riding up there. Oh, come on over to the front of the bus. I'll be riding up there. If you miss me on the picket line, you can't find me nowhere. Oh, come on over to the city jail. I'll be rooming right there. I'll be rooming right there. I'll be rooming right there. Oh, come on over to the city jail. I'll be rooming right there. If you miss me in the Mississippi River, you can't find me nowhere. Oh, come on over to the city pool. I'll be swimming right there. I'll be swimming right there. I'll be swimming right there. Oh, come on over to the city pool. I'll be swimming right there. If you miss me in the cotton fields, you can't find me nowhere. Oh, come on over to the courthouse. I'll be voting right there. I'll be voting right there. I'll be voting right there. Oh, come on over to the courthouse. I'll be voting right there." So,
ah, Since this is Christopher Renner, since this is Women's History Month, it might be appropriate to talk about some of the feminist protest songs. And in 1979, I got my first job teaching at Bishop Kelly High School in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And in the one day in the spring, I'm thinking about this time of the year, there was this ad for a concert, Feminists Against Nuclear Energy. And since I was involved in the local anti-nuclear movement, I thought, well, I need to go to this. How little did I know that the artist would be Holly Nair, a person I had no idea who she was. But as I was one of two men amongst about 500 women, I quickly discovered who Holly Nair was. And there was a couple of songs that she sang, one in which talked about the junta in Chile and how people were disappearing. And another song she sang, I'm Either One or I'm Three or I'm Alone, which was a talk about being a gay person in a straight world, which really hit home to me. And if I've ever encountered, shall we say, a spiritual communion or harmony or encounter with a spiritual being, it was during that concert. And I look back on my life, that's one of the most, that put me on the road to where I am today. And her music still, every time I hear it, it speaks to me in ways that few other people have been able to achieve. And I think it was that combination of bringing together various points, because in 1979, I wasn't out of the closet. So it brought up about a whole series of things that for the first time in my life, I realized I could be free. And I think when music can take you to that point where you can realize that you can be free, then the protest becomes more than a protest. It becomes life-changing. And I'll never forget that concert. Never.
Gene Severs. I have a collection of a few vinyl albums at home, and one of them is a Billie Holiday issue, 1959. The cover is a bust of a blonde bimbo, female, and so her photo, the one that did the album, is a small black and white photo about 3x5 on the back. And then along with vinyl, some more. I've been a fan of Josh White for some time. And I was unable to find through garage sales and Grand Ole Trunk and wherever one of his that I was intrigued by called Chain Gang Songs. So that was one of the few I finally went on eBay and bought. One of the things I was hoping to be with the album was an insert of his lyrics, because that often had been, even with the well, one of the things with the albums is that the lyric sheets, photos, et cetera, are sometimes misplaced or hung on walls or whatever. But on the back of the album, he actually apologizes for making the lyrics discernible to us that maybe wouldn't have gotten the gist of the original versions. But even though I thought that's part of what I was paying for, the lyric sheets was gone. So I'm still in search of that.
I believe Jim has had his hand up since the beginning over there.
By the way, I think this is a great program today. I just really love this. I really liked hearing the story of We Shall Overcome, where it came from, actually. So I remember that was, of course, one of the songs sung at every anti-war movement in the 1960s, and I sang it very lustily back in those days. But the more conservative elements in the country were saying, you know, that song came from Russia. You're singing this communist song. And I'm thinking, well, I really don't know where the song came from. It's still a good song. But I'm very glad to hear to know it's thoroughly American. Second story I was going to relate to that is when my oldest daughter, Karen, was, I think, close to graduating from KU. She and I went to hear Peter, Paul, and Mary sing a concert over in Kansas City. They sang We Shall Overcome, and they said that was the first time they had ever sang it in concert. I couldn't believe it. Peter, Paul, and Mary? But Apparently, they sang it in they recorded it, but they never sung it in concert before. So again, the whole audience joined them. One third story I thought was interesting. There was a documentary, one best documentary in the Academy Awards this year. It's called "Searching for Sugar Man." It's about an American folk singer from Detroit named Rodriguez, who recorded a couple of albums, was sort of lost to American history, but those albums became part of the movement in South Africa, which led to the joining of whites and blacks there to overturn the apartheid system. An American folk singer from Detroit became the source of the movement in South Africa of whites joining with blacks to overturn apartheid. Can you believe that? If you can see the movie, it hasn't shown here in Manhattan, probably never will. You'll have to get it on Netflix or some other place. It's called Searching for Sugar Man, and it's about the effort of some documentary filmmakers to find out who was Rodriguez. And they had no idea he was a folk singer from Detroit.
Oh, I'm Sylvia Beeman. It's interesting you mentioned South Africa, because I was going to say there's a wonderful video. It was available at Digital Shelf called Amandla, and the protest music predated Sugar Man's music, actually. And the people were singing in their native tongue, and the white Afrikaners were so taken with the quaintness and the beauty of the harmonies that they inadvertently perpetuated the movement by having the native black people sing their song all over. And I mean, this is an absolutely wonderful movie. You'll have to hear it. You have to watch it. It's called Amandla, Amandla. And another thing is, I was sort of wondering what happened to the Occupy movement. I participated in Occupy Manhattan, but we didn't have a song. And I wonder if we had, if it would have turned into something more powerful. And, well, maybe we can get going. And just, I wonder if we can sing that song, Revolution, by Tracy Chapman. Well, I don't know if that's beyond you, Larry, but I don't know if that's part of your repertoire.
I just want to ask, are all Unitarian congregations so cool? This was great. I really love this. And I especially want to thank you, Stacy, for bringing into the discussion the African-American hip-hop music. I think there's so many attempts to devalue the significance of that music in terms of protest by painting it as purely commercial. So I'm so grateful you brought it in. And this was just amazing. I think we are the coolest congregation.
Michael Oldfather, about 1951 or two, I know I was 11 or 12, so it was one of those 2 years, the DePauw Army Chorus came to perform as a part of the community concert series. And I went, and it's a group of about 12 or 15 African-American men dressed in great kind of Eisenhower jackets, for those of you who might remember what that was from the Second World War and thereafter. And they just blew me away. I came away thinking, I really want to be a singer, and I want to sing with men. I later realized I could sing with women and have almost as much fun, maybe more. So this is 51 or 52, and like Larry, I didn't know much about racism, but I knew a little bit about it. I knew that the African American men who ran the barber shop, and the ones who ran the shoeshine place, and the man who ran the car wash were all people I liked. And had no idea that anybody else felt any differently about them. A couple of days after the DePauw Army Chorus was there, we learned that neither hotel was willing to have these veterans of the Second World War stay in their places. And so they slept on cots at the YMCA. And my father was so indignant that veterans and singers were mistreated. I think he was indignant because they were black too, but singers and veterans especially. Some years later, I tracked down DePauw, and he had a PhD or doctorate in music. During the Second World War, he led a group of singers that sang without any accompaniment close to battle lines and braved enemy fire and all of the rest. He was an incredible man, and he retired as the music director at Lincoln Center in New York.
Sam Lacy, although I was born in Charleston, West Virginia, and I understand I had a black mammy my first year or two, the rest of my young life was in the North until I got out of college and the Army and came to Topeka in 47 for training at Menninger's. And sort of from that time on, since 47, and then moving to Manhattan in 58, I think a lot of what we've been talking about was repeated in Kansas, as it might have been in South Africa. In Topeka in 47, blacks had to sit at the back of the theaters. They could not eat on Kansas Avenue in Topeka except in our liberal veterans organization that died, American Veterans Committee, that had a loft on the main street where they served sandwiches. When one of the popular places for whites to go for lunches in Topeka had a sign right out in front that said, "Blacks served in paper bags." It was the way the sign was written. And a little of this was repeated, though things had changed by the time I came to Manhattan in 58. And our black elementary school was just closing or being integrated. The history of Kansas in the 40s, 50s, and since kind of recapitulates a good deal of what we've been talking about this wonderful program today. Thank you.
We have time probably for two more.
Just a quick add-on to what Sylvia and Jim were talking about, this Sugar Man or whatever. I just finished an article in Time magazine that about him, and that he was making his living doing demolition work. Then he finally found out about being popular in South Africa and had sellout concerts there.
Just on the off chance that anybody has not heard of her, I did want to mention a modern-day folk singer named Holly Near. She's from Northern California, sings of women's issues, environmental issues, human rights. You name it. She's fabulous. She continues to tour and is most often hosted by Unitarian churches. So she will, have concerts in the communities for the Unitarian churches. I think it would be lovely if she could come to Kansas. So you can check her out online, hollynear.com or something like that. It's N-E-A-R. And she's been around a long, long time. I knew her in college, and one of her early albums was with Ronnie Gilbert from the Weavers.
Thank you for your comments. When Dick asked me to do this program with him, and I started to do the research for it, originally we were going to focus on Woody Guthrie, and it became apparent very, very early on that he is just a tiny speck in the amount of history there is in song with social action. And I wished, we could have done many, many, many programs and still not covered it all. But I was so very, very amazed at the impact that music can have on people's attitudes and on social change. And I was even more amazed and pleased that tradition continues on today. And we may not know about it because we don't listen to those genres. I don't listen to hip-hop and heavy metal, on a regular basis. But that same content is there, and that call for change and that call for justice. And I would imagine that, you know, in 50 years, somebody will be doing a program only on the lyrics of hip-hop. With that, I would ask you to all go in peace. It's over.